I can remember the first time I cut. It was to see how hard it would be to slice my wrist. Finally, I took the chance and tried to kill myself. It was an odd sensation. I suddenly felt better. This rush actually saved me. I didn't finish the suicide. I tried two more times within a month, each of these times getting deeper and more dangerous. Again, I feel better almost immediately. I found it was like a drug. Those are the comments of a person diagnosed with borderline personality. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Year.
Impulsive, self-damaging behavior such as reckless driving and promiscuity, self-mutilating acts or suicidal gestures, inappropriate anger, frantic efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment, chronic feelings of emptiness. These can all be signs of borderline personality disorder. Officially recognized in 1980 by the psychiatric community, borderline personality disorder is thought to affect 4 million American adults. What is this disorder and what can be done to treat it? Why would anyone engage in self-mutilating acts such as cutting? Why is it called borderline disorder? Joining us to explore these and other questions about borderline personality disorder is Dr. Ronald Diamond, professor of psychiatry, medical director of the Dane County Mental Health Center, and author of Instant Psychopharmacology, as well as the forthcoming book called The Medication Question, Weighing Your Mental Health Treatment Options for Patients and Their Families.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Good to be here.
Well, we have to ask this question right from the get-go. Where's the border? The border between what and what?
It's a terrible term, and it's part of a historical tradition that really doesn't make much sense today. The idea and where the term came from was an analytic idea that if your psychosexual development got stopped too early, you became psychotic. And if it got stopped a bit later, you became neurotic. And if it got stopped right on the border between this area of psychosis and neurosis in your development, then you developed a borderline personality disorder. Now, nobody at this point, or at least not many of us, buy into that particular way of thinking simplistically about psychosexual development. And the term borderline doesn't have any current relevance, except it's the term that for the moment we've been stuck with and have lived with. But it's really a misnomer. There's no borderline to be there. And my guess is the next version of the psychiatry statistical manual will have a different and better term.
So why not refer to the other disorders that come on either side of this border and leave out this whole syndrome, or situation? Is there some validity to the concept?
There is a validity to the concept. And there are a group of people that their way of walking through the world causes tremendous distress for them and for the people around them. Now, this gets into the whole idea of what do we mean by personality disorder, which itself is a complicated form. But we can think of what, first of all, is a personality. A personality is our characteristic way of being in the world. And some of us are more orderly, some of us are more planful, some of us are more impulsive, some of us are more in touch with our feelings, some of us are less in touch with our feelings. And your constellation of characteristic ways that you deal and cope and respond to the world is your personality, and I hope that you and most of our listening audience have a personality. And part of the personality is also how flexible it is. How much are you stuck with being a particular way, orderly or thoughtful or planful, and how much can you flex if the situation warrants? So part is your style and part is the plasticity or flexibility.
And part of that is you inherently, but inevitably part of it is the way you interact with other people.
And part of it is biology, and part of it is how we grew up. And all of us who have a personality, which is most of us, find that our personalities work better in some situations than in others. So that if I am looking for a surgeon, I may want somebody who is particularly orderly, obsessive, and detailed-oriented. But if I'm looking for a friend or a partner, I may not. And all of us find that our personalities work better in some situations than in others. That leads to what is a personality disorder. There are some people whose way of walking through the world, their personality style, is so stuck, it's so inflexible and so rigid, and gets them into so much trouble in multiple areas of their life, not just one or two, that it seems like their whole way of walking through the world is disordered. And we call that a personality disorder. At least that's the official term. Of course, it sounds terrible. It's one thing to say I have a broken leg. It's even worse to say I have a depression, which is part of me. But to say my entire personality is disordered is to leave me nonplussed. I mean, what do I do with that, and how do I not feel bad about myself if that is the label that's applied? And so this whole terming of personality disorder, I think, is problematic.
I would think it's also hard to tell, let's say you have a teenager who's acting a certain way, how much of it is a personality disorder and how much of it is something where the parenting skills aren't being applied appropriately, where peers are applying pressure in a bad way. How do you tell when somebody is simply acting out or acting up as opposed to having a disorder that they can't help?
Great question. And again, these are complicated issues. Part of it is this a fixed and enduring process, or is it something that's relating to stress? Under tremendous stress, all of us are going to behave at our worst self, at least at times. And you'll see people who appear to have a, quote, personality disorder, whatever that means, but it was not there last week, and it's probably not going to be there next week, and it seems to be clearly related to stress that is overwhelming how they normally cope. That's not a personality disorder. That's just having all of your fuses punched by having more stress than you can manage. There are also psychosexual development issues. A two-year-old appropriately behaves in a particular way, a six-year-old a different way, a 16-year-old a different way, and a 26-year-old yet a different way. And so when you talk about what is appropriate or what is effective coping, you have to do it in terms of what is the stress this person is dealing with, how enduring and fixed is it, what is the age of the person, and how much does it, in fact, get in the way of their way of wanting to be in the world.
Of course, if the stress is really there all along, say in a family situation, whose fault is that? Is that my disorder? Is that the problem of the people who are inflicting this stress on me all the time?
And that leads directly to this idea of fault, that there is a fault of who's responsible for this thing. And the first thing I want to say is that nobody chooses to have an illness. Nobody chooses to be borderline or to have schizophrenia or to be depressed. We can talk about how you get there, but I think fault is a notion that gets in the way. And if somebody is behaving in a particular way that is not how they want to act, not how people around them want them to act, is getting in the way of what they would like out of their life, it is not their fault. If they could do a better job, they would. So when we see people reacting in ways that seem to be pretty counterproductive, they're still doing the best job they could, because if they could do it better, they would.
One of the things that I was surprised about, you know, just looking at the statistics, I guess, was how common borderline personality is, because if I read it right, even though it's less well known than schizophrenia and bipolar, there are more people who appear to be affected by it.
And again, I think that part of that is this whole idea of borderline or other personality disorders. The diagnosis is more squishy. It is more difficult to get two people to agree on what is an appropriate diagnosis and what is not. I would say that there is, in fact, a formal technical meaning of the term borderline disorder. Whether I agree with it or not, it does have a meaning that you can use to communicate to another clinician. It also used in a particularly sloppy way to express displeasure with how somebody's behaving, or that you don't like their behavior, in a very non-technical, very pejorative way. And so a lot of times we use the term borderline in ways that are sloppy, that are damaging, that are pejorative. And I don't really know, in a formal sense, what the actual numbers would be.
Well, let's get into a definition then. Let's say somebody comes to see you and you're trying to figure out, you know, do they have bipolar? Do they have schizophrenia? Do they have, you know, what is it they have? What would you say needs to be present for you to come up with a diagnosis of borderline?
Well, first of all, if somebody does have a psychotic disorder or a major mental disorder, I find it very, very difficult to make a diagnosis of borderline disorder on top of that. They get confounded. So somebody can act in self-damaging ways. They can be impulsive, but that could be from their manic episode and not necessarily from having a personality disorder. And when the major mental illness is effectively treated, a lot of what we have ascribed to personality disorder gets much better. I've certainly seen people that have a rapid cycling bipolar disorder where their moods are up and down very rapidly, where they may be suicidal one moment and not suicidal and will never be suicidal again the next moment and then back to being suicidal, and they get ascribed the term borderline. And if you can effectively treat their mood disorder, all of a sudden a lot of that disappears. So if there is another explanation, it's important not to make the diagnosis. I think that the comorbidity of personality disorder and substance use makes it very difficult to figure out which came first. And people with a personality disorder can have a substance use and vice versa, but again, it confuses the picture. Having said that, if somebody comes in and they are generally extremely impulsive, they are chronically thinking about suicide, they are commonly hurting themselves, they are terrified and react badly to real or imagined abandonment, the idea of somebody going away or a friend not being there for them. If they have no ability to tolerate frustration, they often have come into contact with other people who mental health authorities or medical authorities or criminal justice authorities, their world is not working. They've gotten into major problems both with their interpersonal relationships, with their family, with their work, many different areas. Then you start thinking about an enduring fixed way of being in the world that is problematic and not allowing them to do what they want. And then we start thinking about personality disorders. And then you start thinking about specific ones. Is this person somebody who's histrionic, that is, who's so labile and emotional that they can't settle down and focus? Or is this more towards a borderline? Somebody who is recurrently suicidal, feeling suicidal, can't imagine being alone, loses who they are when they are not with other people, we start thinking about borderline. This idea of object constancy is a core part of that. Many of us are very different depending on who we're with. If I'm with my kids, I'm different than if I'm with my friends. I'm different than if I'm giving this interview. And so different aspects of our personality come out. And at the same time, I still have a consistent sense of who I am separate from the people I happen to be interacting with. One of the hallmarks of people with borderline personality disorder is that they really have trouble holding on to who they are outside of the reaction of people around them. It gets very, very confusing for them and very, very confusing for the people they're with.
Any idea as to why? I mean, is it something, you know, in the brain, some biochemical thing or something that happened early on in life? I mean, why would you have a more fragile sense of self?
Well, the why questions in psychiatry are rapidly changing and becoming very exciting from a scientific point of view. At one point, we ascribed everything, of course, just to psychology. And now we understand that there's a really significant interaction between biology and psychology and environment so that these get admixed together. My own view is that there is a strong biological as well as psychological component. And many of the people that I see that I have ascribed this diagnosis to have had some degree of mood lability. Their mood has bounced up and down from the time they were little kids. And you can imagine that if you're a little kid and one day you're happy and one day you're sad and one day you feel like you don't want to live anymore and the next day you're ecstatic, it would get really confusing for you because you're not reacting to the outside world and you learn that you can't trust your internal state. And if on top of that you have some kind of invalidating environment that you grow up in, and the most common and horrific invalidating environment is to be sexually abused by somebody who's supposed to be taking care of you, by a trusted adult figure. But there are other kinds of invalidating environments as well. One of the people I worked with is a woman who, from the time she was little, was very emotional and very labile, and her mood was all over the map. And her parents are wonderfully neat people, but they're mild, they're timid, they are gentle people. And this woman's mother, from the first time I ever met her, said, I didn't know how to be a good mother to this particular daughter. And they look back and they think of themselves as having not been able to appropriately parent this girl, not because they were bad people or bad parents, but because of the fit problem. That's another kind of invalidating environment.
You mean just a kind of personality mismatch.
Personality mismatch in extremes. That is, that this woman's biological temperament was so out of sync in extreme ways from what her family of origin could provide her, and her biological temperament issues were so massive that, in fact, she never learned external controls, just like she never had biological internal controls.
Well, a lot of human relations might be summarized with that word, negotiation.
That's right.
Every interaction we have, in a way, is a negotiation. There's compromise. There's what's in it for you, what's in it for me. How does that negotiation get conveyed or get transacted by somebody with borderline personality?
Well, again, there may be more biology as well as psychology in this than we used to think. We know that ability to tolerate frustration has a big biological genetic component. We know that degree of impulsivity the need to seek novel, constantly changing stimuli has biological components, genetic components, beyond just what your parents taught you or what you learned growing up. We know that there are now some neuropsychological experiments where people with borderline disorder are less able to negotiate, exchange games with other people. This correlates to brain changes that you can see on a functional MRI scanner. And there's some wonderful recent work showing that there are, in fact, some brain abnormalities that directly correlate to some of these negotiation issues. And my own view is that there's a biological component to this, that there's also a psychological component for this. That is, that depending on what your biology is, to some extent, psychology you can learn to overcome. You can compensate for some of these. But if your biology is too far out of whack, or if your development is not enough to compensate for that, then you get somebody who is impaired in their ability to negotiate the world. And negotiate is a good word, because one of the hallmarks of people with borderline disorder is a problem negotiating normal kind of situations. For example, when I got called for this interview, Emily called me, I called her back, and if I happened to reach her at an inopportune time, we would negotiate in about 3 seconds, call me back, this is how you do it, whatever. If, in fact, I'm really bad at that kind of negotiations, and I call her back at a very inopportune time, and I start talking, and she says, look, Ron, can you call me at some other time? And I keep talking. And she says, I'm about to have dinner guests over. Can you call me back? And I keep talking. You can imagine that after a period of time, whether it's 10 minutes or 2 hours, eventually she will hang up on me.
We break off negotiations.
We break off negotiations.
There's no interview.
And the next time I call her, she's immediately angry with me. And I say, why is she so angry? I haven't even done anything. Well, we negotiate with our colleagues, with our friends, with our work partners, and if I cannot do that, if I'm not good at it, then I constantly experience the world as angry at me. I constantly experience myself as not fitting in because, in fact, I don't fit in because I don't know the skills of how to fit in.
I read that for some people with borderline personality, they can go from either idealizing someone to sort of demonizing them, that they're, it's not only that their own sense of self will shift, but also their opinion of other people seems to go up and down.
I think that's an important part of it. And again, we're talking in a stereotypic way like all people with borderline disorder are all the same. And I think one of the things I want to get across is how a label gives very inadequate information. That some people with borderline disorder are brilliant and some are not so smart. Some are great musicians and some are not. Some have major deficits in all of the areas that we're talking about. Some have been able to compensate reasonably well and to deal with some of these things. Not everybody has the same degree of impairment in this as they, just like not all people with diabetes, are equally impaired in glucose management. So we're talking about a stereotypic approach that doesn't fit any individual. Having said that, there is a tendency, I think, on the part of people that we label as borderline to see the world in blacks and whites instead of gray. And that might mean that if somebody meets me, they may think I'm the best psychiatrist they've ever met. I'm going to save their life. Thank God they finally met me. But that's not something I can live up to. At some point, I'm going to mishear something. I'm going to not be available. I'm going to disappoint that person. And at that point, I go from being the best psychiatrist in the world to the worst psychiatrist in the world. Most of us along the way from childhood to adulthood learn to see the world in shades of gray. He usually is a pretty good psychiatrist, but sometimes he doesn't listen. Usually he's there for me, but sometimes he takes a vacation and I get angry that he's not there. These are the nuances that people with borderline disorder have trouble learning. They do learn it. People with borderline disorder get better over time, but this is the kind of issue that gives them difficulty in negotiating the world.
They see it black and white, but they're still not really assertive enough to negotiate their way through to a goal that they're after?
They're assertive enough. They're not skilled enough. It's a skill deficit. Again, this goes back and forth in different ways. In our negotiations, a lot of times, we make contracts with each other. If you're seeing me as a psychiatrist, for example, you might say, can you give me an extra appointment? And with that, I think I'll be able to be safe.
Right.
Or can you give me an extra appointment? And I realize that's an unusual event and you normally will not be able to do that. So I give you something now and you promise future behavior later. It's like a loan. If, in fact, I give you whatever it is you've requested and you can't follow through with your end of it, I start reacting as though you've broken your end of the contract. And then that's another way that these negotiations fail. The next time you ask for something, I am unwilling or less willing to give it because last time it didn't do any good. Or the last time you asked for something, I said, this is an unusual one-time event. Don't count on it. I can't always be there for you. And then you come to expect that I will be and get angry that I'm not.
So what's the psychological or physiological role of addiction then in that? I mean, it sounds as if that's certainly an addictive personality. If you just one more pill or one more drink and I can get through this.
Well, there are certainly people with borderline disorder who become addicted to substances, but I don't think that's necessarily – just like the issue about cutting has an addictive component to it. Addiction is constantly chasing feeling better or at least not feeling bad. I think borderline disorder is more the world is a confusing, not understandable place, and I can't quite figure out the rules. And I keep desperately trying to figure out rules that don't make any sense to me.
And nobody is solid and consistent enough to get me through.
And it's very difficult to be solid and consistent with somebody who is that inconsistent themselves. So that, again, with many people, if they're hurting a lot and I give them an extra phone call or some extra time or you're as a brother or as a family member do, that helps them soothe themselves and they get through it. And there's always a negotiation between what you need and how much I can give you. And we, again, meet in the middle of that. If, however, the more I give you, the more you need. If I give you some, you need more, and I give you some and you need more, and it's never satisfying to you and I can never give you enough, then at some point I've given you more than I can keep giving you and I burn out.
And it's not necessarily good for you anyway.
And it's not good for either part of that. But what it does then is destabilize the relationship so that with most of the people I work with, most of the patients I work with, if they need some extra time, if they need some extra contact, if they need emergency response, if they need some kind of collaboration around negotiating some kind of special need, I will try and respond to that. On the other hand, there are a group of people with borderline disorder where if you give them more, that's not enough. It's never enough. And to maintain a stable relationship, which, as you put, is the first goal, it means that instead of talking about what this person needs, I need to talk about what I can give over time. So that with other people, if I give them an extra session or an extra couple sessions or something extra, and this is true whether I as a psychiatrist or you as a brother or you as a friend, then that is satisfying and helpful to both people. But if I give and you're not satisfied, I give more, you're not, then it's destabilizing. And the only way I can achieve a stable relationship with you is to be much more arbitrary and rigid about what it is I can give. I give based on what I can give over a long period of time, not over what you necessarily need, because I can't provide what you need. What I can provide is the basis of learning how to be in a long-term stable relationship.
We're going to look more at the diagnosis and treatment of borderline personality disorder when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Dr. Ronald Diamond, and we're talking about borderline personality disorder. One of the symptoms, or I guess, of this personality disorder can be self-mutilation, including cutting. Now, it seems, you know, such a, I guess, upsetting thing to have someone who is deliberately trying to hurt themselves in this way. Can you talk about that and how it fits in with this personality disorder?
Sure. First of all, it sounds very odd and certainly off-putting, but it's not that unusual. When you think about it, how many times have you had a scab that when you pick at it, it hurts, and yet you keep picking at
it? Mm-hmm.
Or you've had a sore tooth, and every time you push your tongue against it, it hurts, and yet you keep pushing your tongue against it. And it turns out that small amounts of controlled pain is very anxiolytic. It's anxiety, and it has mild addictive almost properties to it. At the same time, if you had that scab that you've been picking out, you would be very uncomfortable and would not like it if I came and ripped that scab off. So we're not talking about people who want pain. We're talking about people who want controlled amounts of pain and find that that, in fact, blocks other kinds of pain and helps them focus attention and feel less anxious. And it turns out that cutting controlled amounts of pain is a coping mechanism that people use, not just people with borderline disorder, but across the board. It's just that people with borderline disorder tend to use it more and more out of control. Cutting focuses your attention. It focuses you on physical pain instead of psychic pain, which is harder to grab hold of. I've heard patients say that if they see blood, it reminds them that they're alive when they feel dead. It reminds that there's something warm inside of them when they feel absolutely cold. One of the people I've worked with talked about cutting as a way of avoiding killing herself, and she became really suicidal when the cutting didn't work. One of the problems, besides the fact that it's so off-putting to others, is that as with other kinds of anti-anxiety kinds of coping mechanisms, it can be a bit addictive, and people can start cutting more often, more deeply, more out of control than they themselves intended. But again, cutting and burning, while it sounds really odd, is really not that different than what we do, many of us do, without thinking much about it. It's just more out of control, more grotesque, more off-putting, and more disconcerting both to the person doing it and to people around. Most people who cut understand that it helps them, but also don't like it, because it is such an odd and weird kind of thing that people don't understand.
And how is it related to borderline personality? I mean, do people with borderline personality simply have a higher rate of engaging in this activity?
Right. If, in fact, you do surveys of college-age kids, you find that a fairly high percentage of these kids have at some point engaged in some kind of physical harm to themselves while they're not intoxicated as a way of getting in control of their own feelings or feeling less anxious. There's one study that shows that something like 4% of Air Force inductees, a pretty healthy group, admitted that at one point, while not intoxicated, they cut or hurt themselves in some way to get back in control of themselves or to feel less anxious when they were feeling otherwise out of control. The issue with people with borderline disorder is it's more prevalent, more common, more out of control. It's a more common coping mechanism, and it, as a coping mechanism, gets in their way because it leaves scars, it's embarrassing, it's socially disfiguring, and it's off-putting to other people.
Is it ever a matter, though, of guilt and punishment? How would you make the distinction?
All these things are really mixed together. And so the same person who cuts as a way of coping with their own anxiety and their own distress is often somebody who feels like often they should be punished. And so the punishing of themselves gets mixed in with all of this other stuff as well. And of course, the same person who cuts one moment may be really suicidal the next moment. So when somebody does cut, I often ask, did you need to hurt yourself or did you intend to kill yourself? The same behavior may go both ways, and I ask the person for their explanation and definition of it.
Is it more common among women?
The whole issue of borderline is more common among women, and cutting is much more common among women. If you think in some grotesque way of borderline as being a two-dimensional, stereotypic exaggeration of female characteristics, one way of thinking about this, and I don't want to be very scientific because I can't back this up, the characteristic sociopathic cartoon of male characteristics is to be sociopathic. And some people have suggested that there is an analogy, a metaphor, between the high incidence of borderline in females and the high incidence of sociopathy in men, and they may have certain characteristics in common.
So women, if I'm getting this right, would tend to be more inward-directed and men
right.
more outer-directed.
That's right. They're more inward-directed, more likely to hurt themselves in certain kinds of ways, more likely to be overwhelmed by their own feelings. Men are more likely to be outside-directed, ignore their own feelings, blame other people for their distress. These are really stereotypes that I don't want to take. They're cartoons, but in fact, it's interesting to think about.
What about risk-taking behavior in general, though?
Well, both people with borderline disorder and people with sociopathy tend to engage in a lot of risk-taking behavior. And so I don't know where that cuts the mustard. The risk-taking is really quite different, though. The risk-taking in many people with borderline disorder, most of whom are women, can be involved in drug use. It can be involved in speeding in a car. A lot of it is involved in sexual promiscuity, getting themselves into dangerous situations with other people, engaging in other kinds of high-risk situations that might, in fact, lead to damage to themselves.
But we don't wonder then about people, and I won't make a gender distinction here, who have this compulsion to rappel up, you know, steep cliffs and that kind of thing, much more so than you or I or millions of other people would do?
Well, this gets into the idea of when is something a personality disorder and when is it a personality? When is it socially sanctioned and when is it not? Somebody who's obsessive and a surgeon is considered good. Somebody who's obsessive in some other way may not. So there are huge value overlays to this. And when it works for the person, even if it's high risk or low risk, it works for the person. What we're talking about is not the person who's a little bit more risky or who has a little bit more interpersonal difficulty or who is a little bit more emotional and has trouble controlling that. We're talking about people three standard deviations out who, by their own standards, as well as the people around them, say, this is not working for me. This is really massively, in all areas of my life, getting in my way. So again, I think it's important. If the person says, my world is working pretty well, they're unlikely to have anything I would diagnose as a borderline personality disorder.
Success has something to do with that, too, I suppose. If you keep getting to the top of the mountain, then you get the social sanction and you're fairly happy for the time being?
Perhaps, although I've seen in the course of my 35 years some people who were professionally extremely successful. I saw one woman for a while who was an author who was certainly much more eminent in her chosen field than I was. At the same time, her interpersonal relationships, both at work and at home, her ability to maintain relationships were terrible by her standards. She was chronically suicidal. She was damaging herself. So there was an area in which she was really quite successful, but it wasn't enough.
Alas, that sometimes makes for a great book.
That makes for a great book.
What about the question of empathy? Because one of the examples you gave earlier was if you had borderline, you might have called me up and not picked up on the fact that it wasn't a good time to talk and kept on talking, which seemed as if, to me, almost the way someone with autism, Asperger's or something would not pick up on what I was going through, not enter into my life.
Yeah, I think that people with borderline disorder often are super empathetic. I think they're exquisitely sensitive to how other people are feeling around them. The problem is that they get confused about what the other person is feeling and what they're feeling. They get confused about how they should respond or deal with it. They are extremely empathetic back about picking up and then reacting to the person. So if I'm dealing with somebody who is, in fact, angry or upset, I become angry or upset. But the issue of empathy is that they're exquisitely sensitive, I think, to the feelings of people around them, perhaps too much. They can't protect themselves very well from the feelings of people around them.
So if I'm talking with you and you start exhibiting some factors of impatience, at what point do I think, well, you need help, you're borderline?
Well, first of all, one of the problems is that clinicians ascribe the term borderline to a whole variety of people where it's really not very useful. There was a study some years ago where they gave therapists a bunch of vignettes and asked, would you want to work with this person? Do you think they're treatable? And the only difference was that some of them had injected in the vignettes, this person's primary care physician thinks they may be borderline.
Well,
that was enough.
Coloring the case.
That was enough to, in fact, get therapists to say, I don't want to work with this person. I don't think they're workable. So it's a very pejorative diagnosis. I don't think that's accurate. I think people with borderline disorder can get better. Most of them do get better. I think that you can do effective therapy and really be useful to these people. So I don't believe in that therapeutic nihilism, but it's out there. A lot of times when patients disagree with their clinicians or they become angry or upset or they become suicidal or hurt themselves, there's an immediate tendency to label this person as borderline in a way that doesn't help because it interferes with the listening. If you're borderline, I don't have to listen to you.
Right.
As against thinking about what is going on between us or what is going on in your life that would help me understand this.
Why is it that way for borderline and not for, say, bipolar or schizophrenia? Is the idea that with borderline there's more of a manipulation?
I think there's more of a manipulation. I think there's more of a pejorative sense. It used to be that being called a schizophrenic meant that nobody wanted to work with you because there's nothing to be done. Well, we've learned a lot about how to work with people with schizophrenia, and we've learned a lot about how to work with people with bipolar disorder. We also have learned a lot about how to work effectively with people with borderline disorder, but it's still off-putting to a lot of clinicians who have a sense of therapeutic nihilism about it.
And how much of it could be a sort of act? In other words, let's say I'm threatening suicide and so on. How much of it is an attention-getting device for whatever reason, as opposed to something that's truly reflecting depression?
You know, words are really important and interesting. So when we say this person is attention-seeking, we think of that as a bad thing. And the reality is that there are very few people more attention-seeking than I am. I'm here on radio with people all over the state listening. I give a lecture to 200 people, and they all pay rapt attention for an entire day. That is attention-seeking. The problem with people we label borderline is that they want attention, and they're cruddy at it. If they were good at it, we'd call them comics or artists.
Isn't that
or
true?
Theater people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we use words as a way of not having to listen to the pain that this person is in. The problem with somebody who is, quote, attention-seeking is that they're not good at it. The problem with the person who we call manipulative is they're not very good at asking for what the rest of us take for granted. If I ask a favor for you, I'm likely to have you say yes to me. Or if you say no in a way that leaves our relationship intact. But if I'm really bad at asking for things, if I'm really cruddy at it, if I don't have the skills at it, I'm likely to ask for something in a way that, first of all, I'm not likely to get it. And second of all, you're likely to be angry with me for the way I've asked. So manipulative is a term we apply to people who are not very good, not very skilled at asking for things. Attention-seeking is a term we apply to people who want attention and are cruddy at getting it in positive ways.
Well, part of it would have to be, too, I think, if we get back to this idea of negotiation, what's in it for you, what's in it for me, is what does that person with the disorder have to offer that would make you pay attention to them?
And again, that's a skill problem.
Right.
That somebody we label manipulative is not skilled enough to enter into that kind of negotiation, and therefore they actually get much less out of the world and much less out of people around the world than what the rest of us take for granted.
What about for a person with borderline personality who falls in love? What would be the typical pattern that would help you make a diagnosis of borderline in terms of the relationships with other, with the opposite sex?
Well, first of all, again, we're stereotyping. Yes, mm-hmm. I have worked with people with borderline disorder who have gotten into genuine, stable, long-term relationships with people that have lasted over time, which is at least as good as what the rest of us would like to achieve. So I don't want to be too stereotypic about this, but the classic pattern is the instant infatuation where the person is incredibly all perfect and all wonderful and all loving, is going to give me everything I ever wanted to have,
and then
in a way that mm-hmm. cannot possibly be maintained. And many of us who have been in love go through the period of infatuation, which is heady and wonderful and emotional, and we come out the other end with a kind of warm regard surrounding a sense of love, which may not be quite as emotionally charged, but is much more stable. And people with borderline disorder, I think, have trouble in that transition to the warm fuzzies as against the emotional
charge.
And for the person on the other end, the person that's in their relationship, how would that come up? Well, they would see the person as increasingly needy, as increasingly critical.
Sure, because they can't possibly maintain that sense of, I'm never going to be as perfect as this person initially thought. And when this person then complains about me and belittles me and criticizes me and I can't do enough and I can't possibly do enough, it feels bad on both ends. Again, as people start listening to this, they say, I recognize that. All of what we're talking about exists in various ways, more or less, in all of our relationships. What we're talking about is not somebody who's like this a bit, but somebody who is really out of control of this to the point where it's very, very difficult for them to enter into and maintain any kind of stable relationship. And one of the things that people learn over time in therapy is how to overcome these natural tendencies so they can maintain stable relationships.
And so to get back to the classic nature-nurture question, I know it's always both, but I mean there are people who are then more predisposed to this kind of relationship failure, and then also there are possibly elements in their early development that exacerbate it.
Right. And of course, there are lots of ways that people can have relationship failures. There are people who are not very empathetic and go through multiple relationships because the other person is never good enough. There are people who have, say, a bipolar disorder, and every time they're manic, they marry a different person. There are people who are more withdrawn and just have trouble connecting in an intimate way. There are lots of ways that one can avoid being successful in relationships. So having a borderline disorder is just one of a number of ways. Now, I don't want to pretend that everybody who has trouble with relationship is necessarily borderline or manic or anything else. They just might not be very successful in relationships.
But you could actually be a borderline personality disorder, and if you connect with the right person, you could live a, I'll say, normal, happy, productive life. It's a key in the fit that you mentioned earlier.
You know, I have a sister and a brother-in-law who have been married for 40-some years, and I was talking to them, and they said something I thought was very wise, which is the way to having a long and happy relationship is not finding the right partner, it's being the right partner. And I think that part of it is finding the right person, but I think that for somebody with a borderline disorder, that's never going to be enough. And I think that people over time can learn skills that are not natural. They can learn to overcome some of their natural instinctive reactions. They can learn to rethink the world in different ways. And I think that that's what all of us need to do to be in successful relationships. And I think that's what people with borderline disorder can do, even if for biological or psychological reason that's more difficult for them.
So, for example, if I'm more inclined to have this kind of separation anxiety, would that be a part of
Sure.
borderline personality disorder? And I meet somebody who somehow says, I can't be here for you all the time, but I'm not going to leave you. I'll be with you. You know, very reassuring in that regard.
And also when you then become upset that I have gone on vacation or I'm not home, I don't have to react to your upsetness. There are people who, in fact, can help through their consistency and constancy and calmness to help you out. At the same time, you, the person with borderline disorder, need to learn how to cope with your feelings of doom and disaster when this person is not there for you, because your feelings can overwhelm any relationship if you can't, in fact, get a handle on them.
We're going to talk about therapy and medication and other ideas for treating borderline personality disorder when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Dr. Ronald Diamond, who's a psychiatrist and is telling us about borderline personality disorder. And I think before we get into treatment and therapy, we should revisit exactly what it is we're looking for if we're talking about borderline personality disorder.
Well, first of all, we're talking about a personality disorder, which means this person's way of walking through the world gets them into trouble in almost all life areas. It's not just a problem at home or just a problem at work, but their way of interacting with other people pervasively and consistently leads to significant distress and dysfunction so that they can't be in the world the way they want. Typically, it's a group of people that have unstable relationships, that are chronically suicidal, that are chronically hurting themselves in one way or the other, that are often impulsive, have tremendous difficulty with real or imagined abandonment, whose mood is often quite unstable, and who themselves don't understand why the world doesn't work better than it does. These are people that can be very bright and very creative and very artistic, and they walk through the world saying, why me? The world just doesn't work. I don't understand the way the world is. We all have bits and elements of this, but we're talking about a group of people whose problem of negotiating the world and being in stable relationships is three orders of magnitude more than what most of us experience in the normal range of things.
And we have indicated that it can be done with the right kind of relationship, but what other approaches are taken these days to borderline personality disorder too? I assume it's not curable exactly, but more treatable?
I think most of what we do in medicine across the board and what I do as a psychiatrist is help people manage things that aren't going to get cured, but you can go on to live a reasonable life, and that's good enough for me. The work that really started modern treatment is a woman by the name of Marsha Linehan, who put together something on dialectical behavioral therapy, or DBT. And other people have worked before her and after her, but she put the package together and is basically her ideas still seem to hold central sway. It starts with the idea that this is a problem of skills. It's not that you're a bad person. It's not your fault. But that, in fact, there are specific skills that for whatever biological or psychological reason you don't have. That the problems you have in the world are not your fault. You didn't make them up, and if you could do a better job, you would. You're doing the very best you could, because nobody would choose to be like this if, in fact, they could do it better. And that even though this is not your fault, and even though you're already doing the very best you can, if anything's going to change in your life, you're going to be the one who has to change it, because other people can't. So there is this dialectical opposition between saying it's not your fault and you're doing the best you can, and if something's going to change, you have to change it. And then the essence of therapy is two-part. One is to figure out how to be in a stable relationship as a clinician with somebody for whom that is the core deficit. And the other then is to help this person learn a series of skills through homework assignments, through exercises, through becoming more aware of what their internal thought processes are so they can get more control over automatic thoughts that otherwise control them. For example, one of the exercises is to get people to start paying attention to what they're saying to themselves, what their automatic tapes are in the back of their head, to get people to start paying attention in a mindfulness way to how they're feeling instead of automatically reacting. Many people with this disorder, as well as the rest of us, automatically react to things. If you stop and say, how am I feeling? What is going on? If, in fact, you ask people to do a self-rating scale of mood or intensity of anger or wanting to cut yourself, the process of doing a rating scale means stepping outside of yourself to look at yourself in a quasi-outside way.
It would seem to me it would be awfully hard to change something that was so much a part of your personality. In other words, let's say something happens and I have borderline personality and I instantly get mad and say something or react very strongly. To have the insight that now I need to step back and think about on a scale of 1 to 10, where am I at, and kind of have that, put the brakes on, to make that change must be tremendously difficult.
It is difficult. And that's why this is not something that's done in a session or in 5 sessions. But there are a variety of skills, exercises, and learning systems that teach people basic skills that didn't come naturally. And whenever you learn a skill that didn't come naturally, if you grew up learning English, English is natural. If you now try to learn Russian, it's probably not natural. So we're trying to help people learn how to do things that they could learn how to do and use, but that may not be natural. And then there are a variety of tricks, strategies that help. For example, if you are having a problem reacting to things way too rapidly, and we've had a conversation about that, but right when you most need to use that conversation, you forget it. And you now put a smooth stone in your pocket or a special key or something on your wrist. That can remind you right there as a transitional object of all those things we just talked about. One of my patients who may be listening to this put together a whole variety of very short sayings that she wanted to remind herself of. I'm okay. Don't get angry. Think about what you're doing. And she laminated these and has a whole collection of them. And every morning she gets up and thinks, which ones does she want to put on her keychain today? And the process of picking one out of her drawer, deciding what is her message for herself that day, these are things she herself have come up with, putting it on the keychain is an act of mindfulness, of thinking about what her processes are so they become less automatic for her. And she's found that tremendously useful.
And I would think empowering to her, because she's the one making the decision.
That's right.
She's the one executing the decision.
And one of the other pieces of this kind of treatment, it is not somebody else changing you. It is giving you skills that you can use to change in ways that you want to change. This is not done to somebody. This is really very much collaboratively done with somebody.
It sounds as if people with borderline personality maybe have less difficulty identifying that they have problems and that they will come in to get treatment, because, I mean, a lot of other mental illnesses, one of the problems is people who don't think that there's anything wrong with them. But from what you've said, it sounds as if someone with borderline personality, for the most part, is very much aware that things are wrong.
Absolutely. Their life is full of distress and pain. They may have given up on therapy and therapists. They may feel hopeless that it can change, but they would desperately like their life to be better than it is.
And what about medication? Because so many other illnesses, bipolar, schizophrenia, and so on, are heavily dependent on the right, you know, pharmacology.
Well, in fact, I have a whole chapter in my book on medicating people with borderline disorder. And there is a role for medication, but it's a secondary role. And there's no particular medication for borderline disorder. At the same time, there are medications that may help people deal with some of the symptoms, that may help deal with some of the depression, that may help deal with some of the mood lability. We've not talked about this, but chronic PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, based on childhood trauma, is an uncommonly, very common part of this. And you get people who have night terrors, who have a kind of numbness from that, who have overreactivity to the world. There are medications that to some extent can help some of the symptoms of PTSD. So there are very specific medications that can help some parts of the symptom complex. The problem is that before you start throwing medications at somebody who's desperate and needy and wants things to change, you have to go through a process of working with the person to be very, very clear what you want the medication to accomplish. What would getting better and getting worse mean? How would we know that? It's hard for somebody who's inherently in an unstable relationship with all parts of the world to take medication consistently enough for it to have any chance of working. And many of the people I've worked with have had many, many med trials, none of which have worked, because they've never been able to stay on the medication, tolerate the side effects long enough to find out, or their expectations of what the medication will do is so unrealistic that even if the medication were working a bit, they wouldn't notice it. So setting up an effective medication strategy, setting up a collaborative trial that you and the person together can say, this is what we're going to try for this reason, this is how we'll know, this is what getting better means, that we can try it, that becomes a difficult process. With that, there are medications that can help some of the symptoms that make life difficult.
Medication is likely to be a permanent or a temporary part of treatment for most people with borderline personality disorder.
Yes. and that means that as with other things, the decision to use medication and how long to use it and for what purposes must be a collaborative decision between the prescriber and the patient. How long to stay on the medication must be under the control of the person experiencing it. And they're going to make their own decisions about whether, after a period of time, they want to see if they can cope pretty effectively without it or whether the medication adds enough to their ability to cope that it's worth staying on. Many people who find effective medication strategies stay on them pretty much indefinitely. On the other hand, there are many people with borderline disorder who never find an effective medication strategy that works well enough to justify staying on it. At least it's important to know where medication will work and where it will not.
We'll put some resources on our University of the Air website for books and places to go for more information. Any final thoughts for families of people with borderline personality or someone who has borderline personality disorder?
I think reading about it, getting knowledgeable about it, finding out what it is, because there are ways in which families can cope more effectively to be support people without themselves burning out. I think there are reasons for people with borderline disorder to optimistically be hopeful and to feel like their life can get better. I think there are ways of doing therapy that can help. I think there's some really good self-help books out there that can be useful. So it is a difficult problem that is hard for the people who have it and the people around them. And I think there are room for cautious therapeutic optimism. People do generally get better, and their lives get better, and the people around them feel like their lives get better in response.
Ronald Diamond has been our guest for this hour. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.